From Russia with Love by Ian Fleming, continued. Disc 2.
But of course we shall deny any knowledge of the deed, whatever it may be, and it is desirable that the common people of the Soviet Union should remain in complete ignorance of our complicity. General G. paused, and looked down the table at the representative of Rumid, who again held his gaze impassively. "And now to choose the organization at which we will strike, and then to decide on the specific target within that organization. Comrade Lieutenant General Vozdvizhensky, since you observe the foreign intelligence scene from a neutral standpoint—" This was a jibe at the notorious jealousies that exist between the military intelligence of the GRU and the secret service of the MGB. "Perhaps you would survey the field for us. We wish to have your opinion of the relative importance of the Western intelligence services. We will then choose the one which is the most dangerous, and which we would most wish to damage." General G. sat back in his tall chair. He rested his elbows on the arms and supported his chin on the interlaced fingers of his joined hands, like a teacher preparing to listen to a long construe. General Vozdvizhensky was not dismayed by his task. He had been in intelligence, mostly abroad, for 30 years. He had served as a doorman at the Soviet embassy in London under Litvinov. He had worked with the TASS agency in New York, and had then gone back to London, to AMTORG, the Soviet trade organization. For 5 years he had been military attaché under the brilliant Madame Kollontai in the Stockholm embassy. He had helped train Sogo, the Soviet master spy, before Sogo went to Tokyo. During the war he had been for a while resident director in Switzerland, or Schmidtland, as it had been known in the spy jargon, and there he had helped sow the seeds of the sensationally successful, but tragically misused, Lucy network. He had even gone several times into Germany as a courier to the Rote Kapelle, and had narrowly escaped being cleaned up with it. And after the war, on transfer to the Foreign Ministry, he had been on the inside of the Burgess and Maclean operation, and on countless other plots to penetrate the foreign ministries of the West. He was a professional spy to his fingertips, and he was perfectly prepared to put on record his opinions of the rivals with whom he had been crossing swords all his life. The ADC at his side was less comfortable. He was nervous at Rumid being pinned down in this way, and without a full departmental briefing. He scoured his brain clear and sharpened his ears to catch every word.
"In this matter," said General Vozdvizhensky carefully, "one must not confuse the man with his office. Every country has good spies, and it is not always the biggest countries that have the most or the best. But secret services are expensive, and small countries cannot afford the coordinated effort which produces good intelligence. The forgery departments, the radio network, the record department, the digestive apparatus that evaluates and compares the reports of the agents. There are individual agents serving Norway, Holland, Belgium, and even Portugal who could be a great nuisance to us if these countries knew the value of their reports or made good use of them, but they do not. Instead of passing their information on to the larger powers, they prefer to sit on it and feel important. So we need not worry with these smaller countries." He paused. "Until we come to Sweden. There they have been spying on us for centuries. They have always had better information on the Baltic than even Finland or Germany. They are dangerous. I would like to put a stop to their activities."
General G. interrupted. "Comrade, they are always having spy scandals in Sweden. One more scandal would not make the world look up. Please continue."
"Italy can be dismissed," went on General Vozdvizhensky, without appearing to notice the interruption. "They are clever and active, but they do us no harm. They are only interested in their own backyard, the Mediterranean. The same can be said of Spain, except that their counterintelligence is a great hindrance to the party. We have lost many good men to these fascists. But to mount an operation against them would probably cost us more men, and little would be achieved. They are not yet ripe for evolution. In France, while we have penetrated most of their services, the Deuxième Bureau is still clever and dangerous. There is a man called Mathis at the head of it. A Mendez France appointment. He would be a tempting target, and it would be easy to operate in France.
France is looking after herself, commented General G.
England is another matter altogether. I think we all have respect for her intelligence service.
General Vozvoshensky looked round the table. There were grudging nods from everyone present, including General G.
Their security service is excellent. England, being an island, has great security advantages, and their so-called MI5 employs men with good education and good brains. Their secret service is still better. They have notable successes. In certain types of operation, we are constantly finding that they have been there before us. Their agents are good. They pay them little money, only 1,000 or 2,000 rubles a month, but they serve with devotion. Yet these agents have no special privileges in England, no relief from taxation, and no special shops such as we have from which they can buy cheap goods. Their social standing abroad is not high, and their wives have to pass as the wives of secretaries. They are rarely awarded the decoration until they retire, and yet these men and women continue to do this dangerous work. It is curious. It is perhaps the public school and university tradition, the love of adventure. But still it is odd that they play this game so well, for they are not natural conspirators.
General Vozdvizhensky felt that his remarks might be taken as too laudatory. He hastily qualified them.
Of course, most of their strength lies in the myth of Scotland Yard, of Sherlock Holmes, of the Secret Service. We certainly have nothing to fear from these gentlemen, but this myth is a hindrance which it would be good to set aside.
And the Americans? General G. wanted to put a stop to Vozdvizhensky's attempts to qualify his praise of British intelligence. One day that bit about the public school and university tradition would sound well in court. Next, hoped General G., he will be saying that the Pentagon is stronger than the Kremlin.
The Americans have the biggest and the richest service among our enemies. Technically, in such matters as radio and weapons and equipment, they are the best. But they have no understanding for the work. They get enthusiastic about some Balkan spy who says he has a secret army in the Ukraine. They load him with money with which to buy boots for this army. Of course, he goes at once to Paris and spends the money on women. Americans try to do everything with money. Good spies will not work for money alone. Only bad ones, of which the Americans have several divisions.
They have successes, comrade, said General G. silkily. Perhaps you underestimate them. General Vozdvizhensky shrugged.
They must have successes, comrade general. You cannot sow 1,000,000 seeds without reaping one potato. Personally, I do not think the Americans need engage the attention of this conference.
The head of Rumid sat back in his chair and stolidly took out his cigarette case.
A very interesting exposition, said General G. coldly. Comrade General Slavin?
General Slavin of the GRU had no intention of committing himself on behalf of the general staff of the army.
I have listened with interest to the words of Comrade General Vozdvizhensky. I have nothing to add.
Colonel of State Security Nikitin of MGB felt it would do no great harm to show up the GRU as being too stupid to have any ideas at all, and at the same time to make a modest recommendation that would probably tally with the inner thoughts of those present. And that was certainly on the tip of General G.'s tongue. Colonel Nikitin also knew that, given the proposition that had been posed by the Presidium, the Soviet Secret Service would back him up.
I recommend the English Secret Service as the object of terrorist action, he said decisively. The devil knows my department hardly finds them a worthy adversary, but they are the best of an indifferent lot.
General G. was annoyed by the authority in the man's voice, and by having his thunder stolen, for he also had intended to sum up in favour of an operation against the British. He tapped his lighter softly on the desk to reimpose his chairmanship.
Is it agreed, then, comrade? An act of terrorism against the British Secret Service?
There were careful, slow nods all round the table.
I agree. And now for the target within that organization. I remember Comrade General Vozdvizhensky saying something about a myth upon which much of the alleged strength of the Secret Service depends. How can we help to destroy the myth, and thus strike at the very motive force of this organization? Where does this myth reside? We cannot destroy all its personnel at one blow. Does it reside in the head? Who is the head of the British Secret Service?
Colonel Nikitin's aide whispered in his ear. Colonel Nikitin decided that this was a question he could, and perhaps should, answer.
He is an admiral. He is known by the letter M. We have a zapiska on him, but it contains little. He does not drink very much. He is too old for women. The public does not know of his existence. It would be difficult to create a scandal around his death, and he would not be easy to kill. He rarely goes abroad. To shoot him in a London street would not be very refined.
There is much in what you say, comrade, said General G., but we are here to find a target who will fulfill our requirements. Have they no one who is a hero to the organization? Someone who is admired, and whose ignominious destruction would cause dismay? Myths are built on heroic deeds and heroic people. Have they no such men?
There was silence round the table, while everyone searched his memory. So many names to remember, so many dossiers, so many operations going on every day all over the world. Who was there in the British Secret Service? Who was that man who... It was Colonel Nikitin of the MGB who broke the embarrassed silence. He said hesitantly,
"There is a man called Bond."
Chapter 6 Death Warrant.
Blank Mart. The gross obscenity was a favourite with General G. His hand slapped down on the desk. "Comrade, there certainly is a man called Bond, as you put it." His voice was sarcastic. "Shems Bond." He pronounced it Shems. "And nobody, myself included, could think of this spy's name. We are indeed forgetful. No wonder the intelligence apparat is under criticism."
General Vozdvizhensky felt he should defend himself and his department.
"There are countless enemies of the Soviet Union, Comrade General," he protested. "If I want their names, I send to the Central Index for them. Certainly I know the name of this Bond. He has been a great trouble to us at different times. But today my mind is full of other names. Names of people who are causing us trouble today, this week. I am interested in football, but I cannot remember the name of every foreigner who has scored a goal against the Dynamos."
"You are pleased to joke, comrade," said General G., to underline this out-of-place comment. "This is a serious matter. I, for one, admit my fault in not remembering the name of this notorious agent. Comrade Colonel Nikitin will no doubt refresh our memories further. But I recall that this Bond has at least twice frustrated the operations of SMERSH. That is," he added, "before I assumed control of the department. There was this affair in France at that casino town, the man Le Chiffre, an excellent leader of the party in France. He foolishly got into some money troubles, but he would have got out of them if this Bond had not interfered. I recall that the department had to act quickly and liquidate the Frenchman. The executioner should have dealt with the Englishman at the same time, but he did not. Then there was this Negro of ours in Harlem, a great man, one of the greatest foreign agents we have ever employed, and with a vast network behind him. There was some business about a treasure in the Caribbean. I forgot the details. This Englishman was sent out by the Secret Service and smashed the whole organization and killed our man. It was a great reverse. Once again my predecessor should have proceeded ruthlessly against this English spy."
Colonel Nikitin broke in.
"We had a similar experience in the case of the German tracks and the rocket. You will recall the matter, Comrade General. A most important conspiratia. The general staff were deeply involved. It was a matter of high policy which could have borne decisive fruit, but again it was this Bond who frustrated the operation. The German was killed. there were grave consequences for the state. There followed a period of serious embarrassment which was only solved with difficulty.
General Slavin of GRU felt that he should say something. The rocket had been an army operation, and its failure had been laid at the door of GRU. Nikitin knew this perfectly well. As usual, MGB was trying to make trouble for GRU, raking up old history in this manner.
"We asked for this man to be dealt with by your department, Comrade Colonel," he said icily. "I cannot recall that any action followed our request. If it had, we should not now be having to bother with him."
Colonel Nikitin's temples throbbed with rage. He controlled himself.
"With due respect, Comrade General," he said in a loud, sarcastic voice, "the request of GRU was not confirmed by higher authority. Further embarrassment with England was not desired. Perhaps that detail has slipped your memory. In any case, if such a request had reached MGB, it would have been referred to SMERSH for action."
"My department received no such request," said General G. sharply, "or the execution of this man would have rapidly followed. However, this is no time for historical researches. The rocket affair was 3 years ago. Perhaps the MGB could tell us of the more recent activities of this man."
Colonel Nikitin whispered hurriedly with his aide. He turned back to the table.
"We have very little further information, Comrade General," he said defensively. "We believe that he was involved in some diamond smuggling affair. That was last year, between Africa and America. The case did not concern us. Since then we have no further news of him. Perhaps there is more recent information on his file."
General G. nodded. He picked up the receiver of the telephone nearest to him. This was the so-called Commandant Telephone of the MGB. All lines were direct, and there was no central switchboard. He dialed a number.
"Central Index? Here, General Gubotsa Boyshikov. The Zapiska of Bond. English spy. Emergency."
He listened for the immediate, "At once, Comrade General," and put back the receiver. He looked down the table with authority.
"Comrades, from many points of view this spy sounds an appropriate target. He appears to be a dangerous enemy of the state. His liquidation will be of benefit to all departments of our intelligence apparat. Is that so?"
The conference grunted.
"Also, his loss will be felt by the Secret Service. But will it do more? Will it seriously wound them? Will it help to destroy this myth about which we have been speaking? Is this man a hero to his organization and his country?"
General Vozvyshensky decided that this question was intended for him. He spoke up.
"The English are not interested in heroes unless they are footballers or cricketers or jockeys. If a man climbs a mountain or runs very fast, he also is a hero to some people, but not to the masses. The Queen of England is also a hero, and Churchill. But the English are not greatly interested in military heroes. This man Bond is unknown to the public. If he was known, he would still not be a hero. In England, neither open war nor secret war is a heroic matter. They do not like to think about war, and after a war, the names of their war heroes are forgotten as quickly as possible. Within the Secret Service, this man may be a local hero or he may not. It will depend on his appearance and personal characteristics. Of these I know nothing. He may be fat and greasy and unpleasant. No one makes a hero out of such a man, however successful he is."
Nikitin broke in.
"English spies we have captured speak highly of this man. He is certainly much admired in his service. He is said to be a lone wolf, but a good-looking one."
The internal office telephone purred softly. General G. lifted the receiver, listened briefly, and said, "Bring it in." There was a knock on the door. The ADC came in carrying a bulky file in cardboard covers. He crossed the room and placed the file on the desk in front of the general and walked out, closing the door softly behind him. The file had a shiny black cover. A thick white stripe ran diagonally across it from top right-hand corner to bottom left. In the top left-hand space there were the letters SS in white, and under them Sovieshno Sekretno, the equivalent of top secret. Across the centre was neatly painted in white letters James Bond, and underneath Angliski Spion. General G. opened the file and took out a large envelope containing photographs, which he emptied onto the glass surface of the desk. He picked them up one by one. He looked closely at them, sometimes through a magnifying glass, which he took out of a drawer, and passed them across the desk to Nikitin, who glanced at them and handed them on. The first was dated 1946. It showed a dark young man sitting at a table outside a sunlit café. There was a tall glass beside him on the table and a soda-water siphon. The right forearm rested on the table, and there was a cigarette between the fingers of the right hand that hung negligently down from the edge of the table. The legs were crossed in that attitude that only an Englishman adopts, with the right angle resting on the left knee and the left hand grasping the ankle. It was a careless pose. The man didn't know that he was being photographed, from a point about 20 feet away. The next was dated 1950. It was a face and shoulders, blurred, but of the same man. It was a close-up, and Bond was looking with careful, narrowed eyes at something, probably the photographer's face, just above the lens. A miniature buttonhole camera, guessed General G. The third was from 1951, taken from the left flank, quite close. It showed the same man in a dark suit, without a hat, walking down a wide, empty street. He was passing a shuttered shop whose sign said Charcuterie. He looked as if he was going somewhere urgently. The clean-cut profile was pointing straight ahead, and the crook of the right elbow suggested that his right hand was in the pocket of his coat. General G. reflected that it was probably taken from a car. He thought that the decisive look of the man, and the purposeful slant of his striding figure, looked dangerous, as if he was making quickly for something bad that was happening further down the street. The fourth and last photograph was marked Pass, 1953, the corner of the Royal Seal, and the letters Rain Office, in the segment of a circle showed in the bottom right-hand corner. The photograph, which had been blown up to cabinet size, must have been made at a frontier, or by the concierge of an hotel, when Bond had surrendered his passport. General G. carefully went over the face with his magnifying glass. It was a dark, clean-cut face, with a 3-inch scar showing whitely down the sunburnt skin of the right cheek. The eyes were wide and level, under straight, rather long black brows. The hair was black, parted on the left, and carelessly brushed, so that a thick black comma fell down over the right eyebrow. The longish straight nose ran down to a short upper lip, below which was a wide and finely drawn but cruel mouth. The line of the jaw was straight and firm. A section of dark suit, white shirt, and black knitted tie completed the picture. General G. held the photograph out at arm's length. Decision, authority, ruthlessness. These qualities he could see. He didn't care what else went on inside the man. He passed the photograph down the table and turned to the file, glancing rapidly down each page and flipping brusquely on to the next. The photographs came back to him. He kept his place with a finger and looked briefly up. "He looks a nasty customer," he said grimly. "His story confirms it. I will read out some extracts, then we must decide. It is getting late." He turned back to the first page and began to rattle off the points that struck him. First name, Shames. Height, 183 centimeters. Weight, 76 kilograms. Slim build, eyes blue, hair black, scar down right cheek and on left shoulder. Signs of plastic surgery on back of right hand. See Appendix A. All-round athlete, expert pistol shot, boxer, knife thrower. Does not use disguises. Languages French and German. Smokes heavily. N.B. Special cigarettes with 3 gold bands. Vices, drink, but not to excess, and women, not thought to accept bribes. General G. skipped a page and went on. This man is invariably armed with a 2.5 Beretta automatic carried in a holster under his left arm. Magazine holds 8 rounds. Has been known to carry a knife strapped to his left forearm, has used steel-capped shoes, knows the basic holds of judo. In general, fights with tenacity and has a high tolerance of pain. See Appendix B. General G. riffled through more pages, giving extracts from agents' reports from which this data was drawn. He came to the last page before the appendices, which gave details of the cases on which Bond had been encountered. He ran his eye to the bottom and read out, "Conclusion. This man is a dangerous professional terrorist and spy. He has worked for the British Secret Service since 1938 and now see Highsmith, file of December 1950, holds the secret number 007 in that service. The 00 numeral signify an agent who has killed and who is privileged to kill on active service. There are believed to be only two other British agents with this authority. The fact that this spy was decorated with the CMG in 1953, an award usually given only on retirement from the Secret Service, is a measure of his worth. If encountered in the field, the fact and full details to be reported to headquarters, see SMERSH, MGB, and GRU Standing Orders 1951 onwards. General G shut the file and slapped his hand decisively on the cover.
Well, comrades, are we agreed?
Yes, said Colonel Nikitin loudly.
Yes, said General Slavin in a bored voice.
General Vozvyshensky was looking down at his fingernails. He was sick of murder. He had enjoyed his time in England.
Yes, he said. I suppose so.
General G's hand went to the internal office telephone. He spoke to his ADC.
Death warrant, he said harshly. Made out in the name of Shams Bond.
He spelled the names out.
Description. Angliski Spion. Crime. Enemy of the state.
He put the receiver back and leant forward in his chair.
And now it will be a question of devising an appropriate conspiratia, and one that cannot fail.
He smiled grimly.
We cannot have another of those Khokhlov affairs.
The door opened, and the ADC came in carrying a bright yellow sheet of paper. He put it in front of General G and went out. General G ran his eyes down the paper and wrote the words, To be killed. Grubotsa Boyshikov, at the head of the large empty space at the bottom. He passed the paper to the MGB man, who read it and wrote, Kill him, Nikitin, and handed it across to the head of GRU, who wrote, Kill him, Slavin. One of the ADCs passed the paper to the plain-clothes man sitting beside the representative of Rumid. The man put it in front of General Vozdvyshensky and handed him a pen. General Vozdvyshensky read the paper carefully. He raised his eyes slowly to those of General G, who was watching him, and, without looking down, scribbled the Kill him, more or less, under the other signatures, and scrawled his name after it. Then he took his hands away from the paper and got to his feet.
If that is all, Comrade General,
he pushed his chair back. General G was pleased. His instincts about this man had been right. He would have to put a watch on him and pass on his suspicions to General Serov.
One moment, Comrade General, he said. I have something to add to the warrant.
The paper was handed up to him. He took out his pen and scratched out what he had written. He wrote again, speaking the words slowly as he did so.
To be killed with ignominy, Gruboza Boyshikov.
He looked up and smiled pleasantly to the company.
Thank you, comrades. That is all. I shall advise you of the decision of the Presidium on our recommendation. Good night.
When the conference had filed out, General G rose to his feet and stretched, and gave a loud, controlled yawn. He sat down again at his desk, switched off the wire recorder, and rang for his ADC. The man came in and stood beside his desk. General G handed him the yellow paper.
Send this over to General Serov at once. Find out where Kronstein is and have him fetched by car. I don't care if he's in bed. He will have to come. OTL 2 will know where to find him. And I will see Colonel Kleb in 10 minutes.
Yes, Comrade General.
The man left the room. General G picked up the VCH receiver and asked for General Serov. He spoke quietly for 5 minutes. At the end he concluded,
And I am now about to give the task to Colonel Kleb and the planner Kronstein. We will discuss the outlines of a suitable conspiratia, and they will give me detailed proposals tomorrow. Is that in order, Comrade General?
Yes,
came the quiet voice of General Serov of the High Presidium.
Kill him, but let it be excellently accomplished. The Presidium will ratify the decision in the morning.
The line went dead. The interoffice telephone rang. General G said,
Yes,
into the receiver, and put it back. A moment later, the ADC opened the big door and stood in the entrance.
Comrade Colonel Kleb,
he announced. A toad-like figure in an olive-green uniform which bore the single red ribbon of the Order of Lenin came into the room and walked with quick, short steps over to the desk. General G looked up and waved to the nearest chair at the conference table.
Good evening, comrade.
The squat face split into a sugary smile.
"Good evening, Comrade General."
The head of OTDL 2, the Department of SMERSH in charge of operations and executions, hitched up her skirts and sat down. Chapter 7. The Wizard of Ice. The two faces of the double clock in the shiny, domed case looked out across the chessboard like the eyes of some huge sea monster that had peered over the edge of the table to watch the game. The two faces of the chess clock showed different times. Kronstein's showed 20 minutes to 1. The long red pendulum that ticked off the seconds was moving in its staccato sweep across the bottom half of his clock's face, while the enemy clock was silent and its pendulum motionless down the face. But Makarov's clock said 5 minutes to 1. He had wasted time in the middle of the game, and he now had only 5 minutes to go. He was in bad time trouble, and unless Kronstein made some lunatic mistake, which was unthinkable, he was beaten. Kronstein sat motionless and erect, as malevolently inscrutable as a parrot. His elbows were on the table, and his big head rested on clenched fists that pressed into his cheeks, squashing the pursed lips into a pout of hauteur and disdain. Under the wide, bulging brow, the rather slanting black eyes looked down with deadly calm on his winning board. But behind the mask, the blood was throbbing in the dynamo of his brain, and a thick, worm-like vein in his right temple pulsed at a beat of over 90. He had sweated away a pound of weight in the last 2 hours and 10 minutes, and the spectre of a false move still had one hand at his throat. But to Makarov and to the spectators he was still the Wizard of Ice, whose game had been compared to a man-eating fish. First he stripped off the skin, then he picked out the bones, then he ate the fish. Kronstein had been champion of Moscow 2 years running, was now in the final for the third time, and, if he won this game, would be a contender for grand mastership. In the pool of silence round the roped-off top table there was no sound except the loud, tripping feet of Kronstein's clock. The two umpires sat motionless in their raised chairs. They knew, as did Makarov, that this was certainly the kill. Kronstein had introduced a brilliant twist into the Meran variation of the Queen's Gambit Declined. Makarov had kept up with him until the 28th move. He had lost time on that move. Perhaps he had a mistake there, and perhaps again on the 31st and 33rd moves. Who could say? It would be a game to be debated all over Russia for weeks to come. There came a sigh from the crowded tiers opposite the championship game. Kronstein had slowly removed the right hand from his cheek and had stretched it across the board. Like the pincers of a pink crab, his thumb and forefinger had opened, then they had descended. The hand, holding a piece, moved up and sideways and down. Then the hand was slowly brought back to the face. The spectators buzzed and whispered as they saw, on the great wall map, the 41st move duplicated with a shift of one of the 3-foot placards. Rook to knight 8. That must be the kill. Kronstein reached deliberately over and pressed down the lever at the bottom of his clock. His red pendulum went dead. His clock showed 12:45. At the same instant Makarov's pendulum came to life and started its loud, inexorable beat. Kronstein sat back. He placed his hands flat on the table and looked coldly across at the glistening, lowered face of the man whose guts he knew, for he too had suffered defeat in his time, would be writhing in agony like an eel pierced with a spear. Makarov, champion of Georgia. Well, tomorrow Comrade Makarov could go back to Georgia and stay there. At any rate this year he would not be moving with his family up to Moscow. A man in plain clothes slipped under the ropes and whispered to one of the umpires. He handed him a white envelope. The umpire shook his head, pointing at Makarov's clock, which now said 3 minutes to 1. The man in plain clothes whispered one short sentence, which made the umpire sullenly bow his head. He pinged a handbell.
"There is an urgent personal message for Comrade Kronstein," he announced into the microphone. "There will be 3 minutes' pause."
A mutter went round the hall. Even though Makarov now courteously raised his eyes from the board and sat immobile, gazing up into the recesses of the high, vaulted ceiling, the spectators knew that the position of the game was engraved on his brain. A 3 minutes' pause simply meant 3 extra minutes for Makarov. Kronstein felt the same stab of annoyance, but his face was expressionless as the umpire stepped down from his chair and handed him a plain, unaddressed envelope.
Kronstein ripped it open with his thumb and extracted the anonymous sheet of paper. It said, in the large typewritten characters he knew so well, "You are required this instant." No signature and no address. Kronstein folded the paper and carefully placed it in his inside breast pocket. Later it would be recovered from him and destroyed. He looked up at the faces of the plain-clothes man standing beside the umpire. The eyes were watching him impatiently, commandingly. To hell with these people, thought Kronstein. He would not resign with only 3 minutes to go. It was unthinkable. It was an insult to the people's sport. But as he made a gesture to the umpire that the game could continue, he trembled inside, and he avoided the eyes of the plain-clothes man who remained standing in coiled immobility inside the ropes. The bell pinged. "The game proceeds." Makarov slowly bent down his head. The hand of his clock slipped past the hour, and he was still alive. Kronstein continued to tremble inside. What he had done was unheard of in an employee of SMERSH, or of any other state agency. He would certainly be reported. Gross disobedience, dereliction of duty. What might be the consequences? At the best, a tongue-lashing from General G, and a black mark on his zapiska. At the worst? Kronstein couldn't imagine. He didn't like to think. Whatever happened, the sweets of victory had turned bitter in his mouth. But now it was the end. With 5 seconds to go on his clock, Makarov raised his whipped eyes no higher than the pouting lips of his opponent, and bent his head in the brief, formal bow of surrender. At the double ping of the umpire's bell, the crowded hall rose to its feet with a thunder of applause. Kronstein stood up and bowed to his opponent, to the umpires, and finally, deeply, to the spectators. Then, with the plain-clothes man in his wake, he ducked under the ropes and fought his way coldly and rudely through the mass of his clamouring admirers towards the main exit. Outside the tournament hall, in the middle of the wide Pushkin Ulitsa, with its engine running, stood the usual anonymous Black Zik saloon. Kronstein climbed into the back and shut the door. As the plain-clothes man jumped onto the running board and squeezed into the front seat, the driver crashed his gears and the car tore off down the street. Kronstein knew it would be a waste of breath to apologize to the plain-clothes guard. It would also be contrary to discipline. After all, he was head of the planning department of SMERSH, with the honorary rank of full colonel, and his brain was worth diamonds to the organization. Perhaps he could argue his way out of the mess. He gazed out of the window at the dark streets, already wet with the work of the night cleaning squad, and bent his mind to his defense. Then there came a straight street at the end of which the moon rode fast between the onion spires of the Kremlin, and they were there. When the guard handed Kronstein over to the ADC, he also handed the ADC a slip of paper. The ADC glanced at it and looked coldly up at Kronstein with half-raised eyebrows. Kronstein looked calmly back without saying anything. The ADC shrugged his shoulders and picked up the office telephone and announced him. When they went into the big room, and Kronstein had been waved to a chair and had nodded acknowledgement of the brief pursed smile of Colonel Klebb, the ADC went up to General G and handed him the piece of paper. The general read it and looked hard across at Kronstein. While the ADC walked to the door and went out, the general went on looking at Kronstein. When the door was shut, General G opened his mouth and said softly, "Well, comrade?" Kronstein was calm. He knew the story that would appeal. He spoke quietly and with authority. "To the public, comrade general, I am a professional chess player. Tonight I became champion of Moscow for the 3rd year in a succession. If, with only 3 minutes to go, I had received a message that my wife was being murdered outside the door of the tournament hall, I would not have raised a finger to save her. My public know that. They are as dedicated to the game as myself. Tonight, if I had resigned the game and had come immediately on the receipt of that message, 5,000 people would have known that it could only be on the orders of such a department as this. There would have been a storm of gossip. My future goings and comings would have been watched for clues. It would have been the end of my cover. In the interests of state security, I waited 3 minutes before obeying the order. Even so, my hurried departure will be the subject of much comment. I shall have to say that one of my children is gravely ill. I shall have to put a child into hospital for a week to support the story. I deeply apologize for the delay in carrying out the order.
but the decision was a difficult one. I did what I thought best in the interests of the department."
General G. looked thoughtfully into the dark, slanting eyes. The man was guilty, but the defense was good. He read the paper again as if weighing up the size of the offense, then he took out his lighter and burned it. He dropped the last burning corner onto the glass top of his desk and blew the ashes sideways onto the floor. He said nothing to reveal his thoughts, but the burning of the evidence was all that mattered to Kronstein. Now nothing could go on his Zapiska. He was deeply relieved and grateful. He would bend all his ingenuity to the matter on hand. The general had performed an act of great clemency. Kronstein would repay him with the full coin of his mind.
"Pass over the photographs, Comrade Colonel,"
said General G., as if the brief court-martial had not occurred.
"The matter is as follows."
"So it is another death," thought Kronstein, as the general talked, and he examined the dark, ruthless face that gazed levelly at him from the blown-up passport photograph. While Kronstein listened with half his mind to what the general was saying, he picked out the salient facts. English spy. Great scandal desired. No Soviet involvement. Expert killer. Weakness for women, therefore not homosexual, thought Kronstein. Drinks, but nothing is said about drugs. Unbribable. Who knows? There is a price for every man. No expense would be spared. All equipment and personnel available from all intelligence departments. Success to be achieved within 3 months. Broad ideas required now, details to be worked out later. General G. fastened his sharp eyes on Colonel Klebb.
"What are your immediate reactions, Comrade Colonel?"
The square-cut, rimless glass of the spectacles flashed in the light of the chandelier as the woman straightened from her position of bowed concentration and looked across the desk at the general. The pale, moist lips below the sheen of nicotine-stained fur over the mouth parted and started moving rapidly up and down as the woman gave her views. To Kronstein, watching the face across the table, the square, expressionless opening and shutting of the lips reminded him of the box-like jabber of a puppet. The voice was hoarse and flat, without emotion.
"Resembles in some respects the case of Stoltzenberg. If you remember, Comrade General, this also was a matter of destroying a reputation as well as a life. On that occasion the matter was simple. The spy was also a pervert. If you recall..."
Kronstein stopped listening. He knew all these cases. He had handled the planning of most of them, and they were filed away in his memory like so many chess gambits. Instead, with closed ears, he examined the face of this dreadful woman, and wondered casually how much longer she would last in her job, how much longer he would have to work with her. Dreadful? Kronstein was not interested in human beings, not even in his own children, nor did the categories of good and bad have a place in his vocabulary. To him, all people were chess pieces. He was only interested in their reactions to the movements of other pieces. To foretell their reactions, which was the greater part of his job, one had to understand their individual characteristics. Their basic instincts were immutable: self-preservation, sex, and the instinct of the herd, in that order. Their temperaments could be sanguine, phlegmatic, choleric, or melancholic. The temperament of an individual would largely decide the comparative strength of his emotions and his sentiments. Character would greatly depend on upbringing, and whatever Pavlov and the behaviorists might say, to a certain extent, on the character of the parents. And, of course, people's lives and behavior would be partly conditioned by physical strengths and weaknesses. It was with these basic classifications at the back of his mind that Kronstein's cold brain considered the woman across the table. It was the 100th time he had summoned her up, but now they had weeks of joint work in front of them, and it was as well to refresh the memory so that a sudden intrusion of the human element in their partnership should not come as a surprise. Of course, Rosa Klebb had a strong will to survive, or she would not have become one of the most powerful women in the state, and certainly the most feared. Her rise, Kronstein remembered, had begun with the Spanish Civil War. Then, as a double agent inside POUM, that is, working for the OGPU in Moscow as well as for the communist intelligence in Spain, she had been the right hand and some sort of a mistress, they said, of her chief, the famous Andreas Nin. She had worked with him from 1935 to 37. Then, on the orders of Moscow, he was murdered, and, it was rumoured, murdered by her. Whether this was true or not, from then on she had progressed slowly but straight up the ladder of power, surviving setbacks, surviving wars, surviving, because she forged no allegiances and joined no factions, all the purges, until in 1953, with the death of Beria, the blood-stained hands grasped the rung, so few from the very top, that was head of the operations department of SMASH. And, reflected Kronstein, much of her success was due to the peculiar nature of her next most important instinct, the sex instinct. For Rosa Klebb undoubtedly belonged to the rarest of all sexual types. She was a neuter. Kronstein was certain of it. The stories of men, and, yes, of women, were too circumstantial to be doubted. She might enjoy the act physically, but the instrument was of no importance. For her, sex was nothing more than an itch. And this psychological and physiological neutrality of hers at once relieved her of so many human emotions and sentiments and desires. Sexual neutrality was the essence of coldness in an individual. It was a great and wonderful thing to be born with. In her, the herd instinct would also be dead. Her urge for power demanded that she should be a wolf and not a sheep. She was a lone operator, but never a lonely one, because the warmth of company was unnecessary to her. And, of course, temperamentally, she would be a phlegmatic, imperturbable, tolerant of pain, sluggish. Laziness would be her besetting vice, thought Kronstein. She would be difficult to get out of her warm, hoggish bed in the morning. Her private habits would be slovenly, even dirty. It would not be pleasant, thought Kronstein, to look into the intimate side of her life, when she relaxed, out of uniform. Kronstein's pouting lips curled away from the thought, and his mind hastened on, skipping her character, which was certainly cunning and strong, to her appearance. Rosa Klebb would be in her late 40s, he assumed, placing her by the date of the Spanish War. She was short, about 5'4", and squat, and her dumpy arms and short neck and the calves of the thick legs in the drab khaki stockings were very strong for a woman. The devil knows, thought Kronstein, what her breasts were like, but the bulge of uniform that rested on the tabletop looked like a badly packed sandbag. And in general her figure, with its big, pear-shaped hips, could only be likened to a cello. The tricoteuses of the French Revolution must have had faces like hers, decided Kronstein, sitting back in his chair and tilting his head slightly to one side. The thinning orange hair scraped back to the tight, obscene bun, the shiny yellow-brown eyes that stared so coldly at General G through the sharp-edged squares of glass, the wedge of thickly powdered large-pored nose, the wet trap of a mouth that went on opening and shutting as if it was operated by wires under the chin. Those French women, as they sat and knitted and chatted while the guillotine clanged down, must have had the same pale, thick chicken's skin that scragged in light folds under the eyes and at the corners of the mouth and below the jaws, the same big peasant's ears, the same tight, hard, dimpled fists like knobkerries, that in the case of the Russian woman now lay tightly clenched on the red velvet tabletop on either side of the big bundle of bosom. And their faces must have conveyed the same impression, concluded Kronstein, of coldness and cruelty and strength, as this—yes, he had to allow himself the emotive word—dreadful woman of Smash.
"Thank you, Comrade Colonel. Your review of the position is of value. And now, Comrade Kronstein, have you anything to add? Please be short. It is 2 o'clock, and we all have a heavy day before us."
General G.'s eyes, bloodshot with strain and lack of sleep, stared fixedly across the desk into the fathomless brown pools below the bulging forehead. There had been no need to tell this man to be brief. Kronstein never had much to say, but each of his words was worth speeches from the rest of the staff. Kronstein had already made up his mind, or he would not have allowed his thoughts to concentrate for so long on the woman. He slowly tilted back his head and gazed into the nothingness of the ceiling. His voice was extremely mild, but it had the authority that commands close attention.
"Comrade General, it was a Frenchman, in some respects a predecessor of yours, Fouché, who observed that it is no good killing a man unless you also destroy his reputation. It will, of course, be easy to kill this man, Bond. Any paid Bulgarian assassin would do it if properly instructed. The second part of the operation, the destruction of this man's character, is more important and more difficult. At this stage it is only clear to me that the deed must be done away from England, and in a country over whose press and radio we have influence. If you ask me how the man is to be got there, I can only say that if the bait is important enough, and its capture is open to this man alone, he will be sent to seize it from wherever he may happen to be. To avoid the appearance of a trap, I would consider giving the bait a touch of eccentricity, of the unusual. The English pride themselves on their eccentricity. They treat the eccentric proposition as a challenge. I would rely partly on this reading of their psychology to have them send this important operator after the bait.
Kronstein paused. He lowered his head so that he was looking just over General G.'s shoulder.
"I shall proceed to devise such a trap," he said indifferently. "For the present, I can only say that if the bait is successful in attracting its prey, we are then likely to require an assassin with a perfect command of the English language."
Kronstein's eyes moved to the red velvet tabletop in front of him. Thoughtfully, as if this was the kernel of the problem, he added,
"We shall also require a reliable and extremely beautiful girl."
Chapter 8. The Beautiful Lure.
Sitting by the window of her one room and looking out at the serene June evening, at the first pink of the sunset reflected in the windows across the street, at the distant onion spire of a church that flamed like a torch above the ragged horizon of Moscow roofs, Corporal of State Security Tatyana Romanova thought that she was happier than she had ever been before. Her happiness was not romantic. It had nothing to do with the rapturous start to a love affair, those days and weeks before the first tiny tear clouds appear on the horizon. It was the quiet, settled happiness of security, of being able to look forward with confidence to the future, heightened by the immediate things, a word of praise she had had that afternoon from Professor Denikin, the smell of a good supper cooking on the electric stove, her favourite prelude to Boris Godunov being played by the Moscow State Orchestra on the radio, and, over all, the beauty of the fact that the long winter and short spring were past, and it was June. The room was a tiny box in the huge modern apartment building on the Sadovaya Chenogriaskaya Ulitsa, that is the women's barracks of the state security departments. Built by prison labour and finished in 1939, the fine eight-storey building contains 2,000 rooms, some, like hers, on the third floor, nothing but square boxes with a telephone, hot and cold water, a single electric light, and a share of the central bathrooms and lavatories, others on the two top floors consisting of two- and three-room flats with bathrooms. These were for high-ranking women. Graduation up the building was strictly by rank, and Corporal Romanova had to rise through sergeant, lieutenant, captain, major, and lieutenant colonel before she would reach the paradise of the eighth and colonel's floor. But heaven knew she was content enough with her present lot. A salary of 1,200 rubles a month, 30% more than she could have earned in any other ministry, a room to herself, cheap food and clothes from the closed shops on the ground floor of the building, a monthly allocation of at least 2 ministry tickets to the ballet or the opera, a full 2 weeks paid holiday a year, and above all, a steady job with good prospects in Moscow, not in one of those dreary provincial towns where nothing happened month after month, and where the arrival of a new film or the visit of a travelling circus was the only thing to keep one out of bed in the evening. Of course, you had to pay for being in the MGB. The uniform put you apart from the world. People were afraid, which didn't suit the nature of most girls, and you were confined to the society of other MGB girls and men, one of whom, when the time came, you would have to marry in order to stay with the ministry. And they worked like the devil, 8 to 6, 5.5 days a week, and only 40 minutes off for lunch in the canteen. But it was a good lunch, a real meal, and you could do with little supper and save up for the sable coat that would one day take the place of the well-worn Siberian fox. At the thought of her supper, Corporal Romanova left the chair by the window and went to examine the pot of thick soup, with a few shreds of meat and some powdered mushroom, that was to be her supper. It was nearly done and smelled delicious. She turned off the electricity and let the pot simmer while she washed and tidied, as years before she had been taught to do before meals. While she dried her hands, she examined herself in the big oval looking-glass over the washstand. One of her early boyfriends had said she looked like the young Greta Garbo. What nonsense. And yet tonight she did look rather well. Fine, dark brown silken hair brushed straight back from a tall brow and falling heavily down almost to the shoulders, there to curl slightly up at the ends. Garbo had once done her hair like that, and Corporal Romanova admitted to herself that she had copied it. A good, soft, pale skin with an ivory sheen at the cheekbones, wide apart, level eyes of the deepest blue under straight, natural brows. She closed one eye after the other. Yes, her lashes were certainly long enough. A straight, rather imperious nose, and then the mouth. What about the mouth? Was it too broad? It must look terribly wide when she smiled. She smiled at herself in the mirror. Yes, it was wide. But then so had Garbo's been. At least the lips were full and finely etched. There was the hint of a smile at the corners. No one could say it was a cold mouth. And the oval of her face, was that too long? Was her chin a shade too sharp? She swung her head sideways to see it in profile. The heavy curtain of her hair swung forward and across her right eye so that she had to brush it back. Well, the chin was pointed, but at least it wasn't sharp. She faced the mirror again and picked up a brush and started on the long, heavy hair. Greta Garbo. She was all right. Or so many men wouldn't tell her that she was, let alone the girls who were always coming to her for advice about their faces. But a film star, a famous one. She made a face at herself in the glass and went to eat her supper. In fact, Corporal Tatiana Romanova was a very beautiful girl indeed. Apart from her face, the tall, firm body moved particularly well. She had been a year in ballet school in Leningrad and had abandoned dancing as a career only when she grew an inch over the prescribed limit of 5 feet 6. The school had taught her to hold herself well and to walk well, and she looked wonderfully healthy thanks to her passion for figure skating, which she practiced all through the year at the Dynamo Ice Stadium, and which had already earned her a place on the first Dynamo women's team. Her arms and breasts were faultless. A purist would have disapproved of her behind. Its muscles were so hardened with exercise that it had lost the smooth, downward, feminine sweep, and now, round at the back and flat and hard at the sides, it jutted like a man's. Corporal Romanova was admired far beyond the confines of the English translation section of the MGB Central Index. Everyone agreed that it would not be long before one of the senior officers came across her and peremptorily hauled her out of her modest section to make her his mistress, or, if absolutely necessary, his wife. The girl poured the thick soup into a small china bowl decorated with wolves chasing a galloping sleigh round the rim, broke some black bread into it and went and sat in her chair by the window, and ate it slowly with a nice shiny spoon she had slipped into her bag not many weeks before after a gay evening at the Hotel Moskva. When she had finished, she washed up and went back to her chair and lit the first cigarette of the day. No respectable girl in Russia smokes in public, except in a restaurant, and it would have meant instant dismissal if she had smoked at work, and listened impatiently to the whimpering discords of an orchestra from Turkmenistan. This dreadful oriental stuff they were always putting on to please the kulaks of one of those barbaric outlying states. Why couldn't they play something kulturni, some of that modern jazz music, or something classical? This stuff was hideous. Worse, it was old-fashioned. The telephone rang harshly. She walked over and turned down the radio and picked up the receiver.
"Corporal Romanova?"
It was the voice of her dear Professor Denikin. But out of office hours he always called her Tatiana, or even Tanya. What did this mean? The girl was wide-eyed and tense.
"Yes, comrade professor?"
The voice at the other end sounded strange and cold.
"In 15 minutes at 8:30 you are required for interview by comrade Colonel Kleb of OTL 2. You will call on her in her apartment, number 1875, on the 8th floor of your building. Is that clear?" "But, comrade, why? What is—"
The odd, strained voice of her beloved professor cut her short.
"That is all, comrade corporal."
The girl held the receiver away from her face. She stared at it with frenzied eyes, as if she could wring more words out of the circles of little holes in the black earpiece.
"Hello? Hello?"
The empty mouthpiece yawned at her. She realized that her hand and her forearm were aching with the strength of her grip. She bent slowly forward and put the receiver down on the cradle. She stood for a moment, frozen, gazing blindly at the black machine. Should she call him back? No, that was out of the question. He had spoken as he had because he knew, and she knew, that every call in and out of the building was listened to or recorded. That was why he had not wasted a word. This was a state matter. With a message of this sort, you got rid of it as quickly as you could, in as few words as possible, and wiped your hands of it. You had got the dreadful card out of your hand. You had passed the Queen of Spades to someone else. Your hands were clean again. The girl put her knuckles up to her open mouth and bit on them, staring at the telephone. What did they want her for? What had she done? Desperately she cast her mind back, scrabbling through the days, the months, the years. Had she made some terrible mistake in her work and they had just discovered it? Had she made some remark against the state, some joke that had been reported back? That was always possible. But which remark? When? If it had been a bad remark, she would have felt a twinge of guilt or fear at the time. Her conscience was clear. Or was it? Suddenly she remembered. What about the spoon she had stolen? Was it that? Government property. She would throw it out of the window, now, far to one side or the other. But no, it couldn't be that. That was too small. She shrugged her shoulders resignedly, and her hand dropped to her side. She got up and moved towards the clothes cupboard to get out her best uniform, and her eyes were misty with the tears of fright and bewilderment of a child. It could be none of those things. Smersh didn't send for one for that sort of thing. It must be something much, much worse. The girl glanced through her wet eyes at the cheap watch on her wrist. Only 7 minutes to go. A new panic seized her. She brushed her forearm across her eyes and grabbed down her parade uniform. On top of it all, whatever it was, to be late. She tore at the buttons of her white cotton blouse. As she dressed and washed her face and brushed her hair, her mind went on probing at the evil mystery, like an inquisitive child poking into a snake's hole with a stick. From whatever angle she explored the hole, there came an angry hiss. Leaving out the nature of her guilt, contact with any tentacle of Smersh was unspeakable. The very name of the organization was abhorred and avoided. Smersh. Smert Spionam. Death to Spies. It was an obscene word. A word from the tomb, the very whisper of death, a word never mentioned even in secret office gossip among friends. Worst of all, within this horrible organization, Ott Diel II, the Department of Torture and Death, was the central horror. And the head of Ott Diel II, the woman, Rosa Klebb. Unbelievable things were whispered about this woman, things that came to Tatiana in her nightmares, things she forgot again during the day, but that she now paraded. It was said that Rosa Klebb would let no torturing take place without her. There was a blood-spattered smock in her office, and a low camp stool, and they said that when she was seen scurrying through the basement passages dressed in the smock and with the stool in her hand, the word would go round, and even the workers in Smersh would hush their words and bend low over their papers, perhaps even cross their fingers in their pockets, until she was reported back in her room. For, or so they whispered, she would take the camp stool and draw it up close below the face of the man or woman that hung down over the edge of the interrogation table. Then she would squat down on the stool and look into the face and quietly say, "Number one," or "Number 10," or "Number 25. And the inquisitors would know what she meant, and they would begin. And she would watch the eyes in the face a few inches away from hers and breathe in the screams as if they were perfume. And, depending on the eyes, she would quietly change the torture and say, "Now number 36, or "Now number 64. And the inquisitors would do something else. As the courage and resistance seeped out of the eyes, and they began to weaken and beseech, she would start cooing softly. "There, there, my dove. Talk to me, my pretty one, and it will stop. It hurts. Ah, me, it hurts so, my child. And one is so tired of the pain.
one would like it to stop and to be able to lie down in peace and for it never to begin again. Your mother is here beside you, only waiting to stop the pain. She has a nice, soft, cozy bed all ready for you to sleep on and forget, forget, forget. Speak, she would whisper lovingly. You have only to speak, and you will have peace and no more pain.
If the eyes still resisted, the cooing would start again.
But you are foolish, my pretty one, oh, so foolish. This pain is nothing, nothing. You don't believe me, my little dove. Well, then, your mother must try a little, but only a very little, of number 87.
And the interrogators would hear, and change their instruments, and their aim, and she would squat there and watch the life slowly ebbing from the eyes, until she had to speak loudly into the ear of the person, or the words would not reach the brain. But it was seldom, so they said, that the person had the will to travel far along Smersh's road of pain, let alone to the end, and when the soft voice promised peace, it nearly always won. For somehow Rosa Klebb knew from the eyes the moment when the adult had been broken down into a child crying for its mother, and she provided the image of the mother, and melted the spirit where the harsh words of a man would have toughened it. Then, after yet another suspect had been broken, Rosa Klebb would go back down the passage with her camp stool, and take off her newly soiled smock and get back to her work, and the word would go round that all was over and normal activity would come back to the basement. Tatyana, frozen by her thoughts, looked again at her watch. 4 minutes to go. She ran her hands down her uniform and gazed once more at her white face in the glass. She turned and said farewell to the dear, familiar little room. Would she ever see it again? She walked straight down the long corridor and rang for the lift. When it came, she squared her shoulders and lifted her chin, and walked into the lift as if it was the platform of the guillotine.
8th.
She said to the girl operator. She stood facing the doors. Inside her, remembering a word she had not used since childhood, she repeated over and over, "My God, my God, my God." Chapter 9. A Labour of Love. Outside the anonymous, cream-painted door, Tatyana already smelled the inside of the room. When the voice told her curtly to come in and she opened the door, it was the smell that filled her mind while she stood and stared into the eyes of the woman who sat behind the round table under the centre light. It was the smell of the metro on a hot evening, cheap scent concealing animal odours. People in Russia soak themselves in scent, whether they have had a bath or not, but mostly when they have not. And healthy, clean girls like Tatyana always walk home from the office unless the rain or the snow is too bad, so as to avoid the stench in the trains and the metro. Now Tatyana was in a bath of the smell. Her nostrils twitched with disgust. It was her disgust and her contempt for a person who could live in the middle of such a smell that helped her to look down into the yellowish eyes that stared at her through the square glass panes. Nothing could be read in them. They were receiving eyes, not giving eyes. They slowly moved all over her, like camera lenses, taking her in. Colonel Klebb spoke.
"You are a fine-looking girl, Comrade Corporal. Walk across the room and back."
What were these honeyed words? Taught with a new fear, fear of the notorious personal habits of the woman, Tatyana did as she was told.
"Take your jacket off. Put it down on the chair. Raise your hands above your head. Higher. Now bend and touch your toes. Upright. Good. Sit down."
The woman spoke like a doctor. She gestured to the chair across the table from her. Her staring, probing eyes hooded themselves as they bent over the file on the table. "It must be my Zabiska," thought Tatyana. How interesting to see the actual instrument that ordered the whole of one's life. How thick it was. Nearly 2 inches thick. What could be on all those pages? She looked across at the open folder with wide, fascinated eyes. Colonel Clare riffled through the last pages and shut down the cover. The cover was orange, with a diagonal black stripe. What did those colours signify? The woman looked up. Somehow Tatiana managed to look bravely back.
"Comrade Corporal Romanova,"
it was the voice of authority, of the senior officer.
"I have good reports of your work. Your record is excellent, both in your duties and in sport. The state is pleased with you."
Tatiana could not believe her ears. She felt faint with reaction. She blushed to the roots of her hair and then turned pale. She put out a hand to the table edge. She stammered in a weak voice,
"I am grateful, Comrade Colonel."
"Because of your excellent services, you have been singled out for a most important assignment. This is a great honor for you. Do you understand?"
Whatever it was better than what might have been.
"Yes, indeed, Comrade Colonel."
"This assignment carries much responsibility. It bears a higher rank. I congratulate you on your promotion, Comrade Corporal, on completion of the assignment, to the rank of Captain of State Security."
This was unheard of for a girl of 24. Tatiana sensed danger. She stiffened like an animal who sees the steel jaws beneath the meat.
"I am deeply honored, Comrade Colonel."
She was unable to keep the wariness out of her voice. Rosa Klebb grunted noncommittally. She knew exactly what the girl must have thought when she got the summons. The effect of her kindly reception, her shock of relief at the good news, her reawakening fears had been transparent. This was a beautiful, guileless, innocent girl. Just what the conspirazia demanded. Now she must be loosened up.
"My dear," she said smoothly, "how remiss of me. This promotion should be celebrated in a glass of wine. You must not think we senior officers are inhuman. We will drink together. It will be a good excuse to open a bottle of French champagne."
This book is continued on Disc 3.